And now, your hosts for Life from the Pulpit, here's Nick Perez.
That's right, and welcome to the new era of eloquence and exposition. This is Live from the Pulpit, the fastest half-hour podcast in the West, live, local, on location at Merced Church of Christ, deep in the heart of the Central Valley, offering up news and views you can use on Scripture and society with a little help from my friends. I am your host for this half-hour excursion into theology and other sundry matters, the voice of the valley, Nick Perez. Greetings. Welcome to the program. Glad you tuned in. Some say it is as late as 1 a.m. when Jesus and his disciples finally arrive at the Garden of Gethsemane, though this is merely supposition. We have no way of knowing what time it was exactly, but we do know it was a place that was familiar to him and to them. In previous episodes, I've shown how Jesus, it was his custom during this final week of his life to go to the Mount of Olives, Luke 21, verse 37. It was a place of respite. It was a place of renewal. It was a place of prayer. And so it is here in the Garden of Gethsemane that I am persuaded we find Jesus' greatest teaching on prayer. Now, although I've been going through the Gospel of Luke, I want to back up here and notice Matthew's Gospel and what he records in his Gospel concerning the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus prays there. Matthew 26:36 reads, "Then Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, 'Sit here while I go over there and pray.' And taking with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, 'My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me.'" How I translate that into modern vernacular, Jesus is essentially saying, "I'm scared to death." And he is. He's sorrowful. He's troubled. We've never seen Jesus like this before. There's never been any faltering or wavering. There's never been a chink in the armor. And yet here he is, sorrowful and deeply distressed. And he asks his disciples to pray with him. Meanwhile, verse 39, he goes a little farther. "He fell on his face and prayed, saying, 'My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will.'" He throws himself to the ground and he prays for another way. "If it's possible, let this cup pass from me." And by the way, this is the same Jesus who so matter-of-factly in his life has said that he must die. How close is Jesus to losing it here? This isn't a slam dunk. He's capable of getting up and walking out of the garden as far as an individual of free will. Yeah, but he's the Son of God. Right, right. But he's also the Son of Man. He's 100% human. And he has that free will. It seems as though it's just that close. He doesn't want to do this. At least there's part of him that doesn't want to do this. And so he begs for another way. But he also pleads, "Not as I will, as you will." He came to his disciples, he found them sleeping. And he wakes them up and he begs them. He says to Peter, "So could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." He's pleading with them for help. He needs their prayers. Watch and pray. And also watch and pray for yourself that you do not enter into temptation. How is this used, by the way? That at the end of verse 41, "The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." How is that used here in Matthew? Seems as though he's talking about himself. He's talking about how his spirit is willing. He's the one who said, I'm going to Jerusalem, going to die. Spirit is willing, but the flesh, his flesh, is fighting him in this thing. Verse 42, though, he goes again a second time. He goes away and he prays, my Father, if this cannot pass, unless I drink it, your will be done. Ah, it seems as though there's some progress here, isn't there? It seems as, this is different than let the cup pass for me. Now he's saying, well, if it cannot pass, unless I drink it, your will be done. There's progress. How is the progress being made? It's being made through prayer. And it's not just that he's praying tonight. As we've seen in Luke, his entire ministry has been saturated with prayer, where he goes off to desolate places, or he goes up on mountaintops, or he goes off to lonely places, and he prays. For 3 years, he's been praying about this. Jesus, he's cultivated that. He's developed this prayer life for this moment right here. He knows Isaiah 53, that it was the will of Yahweh to crush him. He knows Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's been wrestling with this in prayer for 3 years, ever since Satan tempted him with a way out at the beginning of his ministry. Just stay popular. Verse 43, again, he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the same words again. Same thing he just prayed back there in verse 42. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, sleep and take your rest later on. See, the hour is at hand. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. Here's the powerful conclusion to this whole matter. Verses 45 and 46. It reminds me of the folks who were on the plane on 9/11 that crashed into a Pennsylvania countryside, because they're making phone calls before they try and break into the cockpit, and you can overhear one of them saying on the phone, telling the other one, let's roll. That's what's going on here. This is Jesus saying, let's roll. Hang up the phone. It's time to go. Get up. Let's roll. And so here, listen, the battle of Calvary is won right here in the Garden of Gethsemane. And Jesus has won. Right here, right now, he's ready. But it's interesting, Matthew's focus in his gospel is on Jesus. Matthew is focused on Jesus. You go to Mark chapter 14, verses 32 through 42. It's very similar to Matthew's gospel. The emphasis there, as in Matthew's gospel, the emphasis in Mark is Jesus winning the battle. And there you could make an argument that maybe verse 38 in that account is about the disciples, but it's kind of like Matthew, where it's talking about Jesus. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Very similar. But again, the emphasis is Jesus wins. Bring it on. All right, he's ready to go. Ready to roll. But then you come to Luke's gospel. What's the emphasis in Luke's gospel in Luke 22, verses 39 through 46? The emphasis kind of shifts. Again, Jesus, verse 39, came out and went, as was his custom, to the Mount of Olives. And the disciples followed him. He spent the last week out here in Gethsemane. Verse 40, and when he came to the place, he said to them, pray that you may not enter into temptation. This came later in his exchange with his disciples over in Matthew and Mark. But now it's the leadoff. Why? Well, it's in keeping with Luke's theme, the discipleship theme. The emphasis is on the apostles here in Luke. They're the ones who are vulnerable, just like Jesus is, but now, the emphasis is on their vulnerability. Verse 41, and he withdrew from them about a stone's throw and knelt down and prayed, saying, Father, if you're willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. And there appeared to him an angel from heaven, strengthening him. And being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. And when he rose from prayer, he came to the disciples and found them sleeping for sorrow. And he said to them, why are you sleeping? Rise and pray that you may not enter into temptation. There it is again. But it's interesting how this whole thing plays out here in Luke's gospel. Verse 44, the angel comes and helps him, strengthens him. I think of Hebrews 1 and verse 14 about how angels are ministering spirits for the saints of God. Verse 44, his sweat became like drops of blood. It could be a literal medical condition called hematidrosis. And that fits with Luke, who is a physician who writes this account. But it could also be figurative, just as a way of communicating. He's in extreme agony. He's just dripping with sweat. This is real. And this is excruciating, but both of those items about the angel and the sweat are unique to Luke. Now, the emphasis is on the disciples here because Jesus comes, he finds them sleeping for sorrow. We're not told in Matthew and Mark as to why they're asleep, but here it's in Luke that we have the key to this thing. Why were they asleep? They don't really understand all of the Calvary stuff. I mean, they've heard it. They've heard Jesus talk about it, but they don't really catch what Jesus is throwing here. And they do catch that Jesus, he's been distressed this whole week. Every night, he's been up on Mount Olivet praying. And that stress weighs on them too. But they can't deal with it. At least they don't deal with it properly. They escape. Sleep is an escape. And so they do. They sleep rather than pray. They are exhausted from sorrow. And I'm sure Jesus, he was exhausted. He's scared to death as well. Sorrowful, deeply distressed. But he deals with it in prayer. They deal with it with sleep. Now, there is a tendency to look down upon the apostles for sleeping. But in reality, if we're honest with ourselves in those deep places within us that we don't talk about with others, we know that it would be us sleeping if it wasn't them. Maybe I'm alone in this. Maybe I should just say, if it wasn't them, it would have been me. But I don't think I'm alone in this. Verse 46, the disciples, Jesus says, rise, pray that you may not enter temptation. They're going to lose this thing unless they pray like him. And again, Jesus, he starts and he finishes his ministry the same way, in prayer. When he was baptized, he was praying. Here, as he experiences this baptism of suffering and sorrow, he's praying. He's under control throughout his ministry and his life, and that's how Luke presents him here. He's still in charge, and his enemies are going to take him when he is good and ready. And after praying, now he's ready. So what does this mean for us? Well, that's a quick look at Gethsemane, but I think it's sufficient to draw a couple of application points. Number one, when it comes to overcoming temptation, what do the scriptures say Jesus did to ensure that he was obedient and fulfilled the mission of God in his life? He prayed. He prayed. He prayed continuously. He prayed earnestly. He prayed deeply, with intensity. He prayed eagerly, like a hungry man devouring a meal. That's what it took to ensure for the Son of God, to ensure he would fulfill the mission of God. If it took that kind of prayer for Jesus, the Son of God, throughout his life and his ministry to fulfill and accomplish the purposes of God and the mission of God, do we think we could get by with any less? If it took this kind of prayer for Jesus to win, do we think we can win with any less? What right do we have to think that we can get by with less? And yet so many Christians believe that. And they neglect the discipline of prayer. Listen, when we've got the big issues, when we've got a crisis in life, we typically don't have a problem going to God in prayer. But the thing is that you are prepared for those crises, those big issues in life by what you have done leading up to that. That's what Jesus is showing us here. Three and a half years of ministry, all leading up to this, and those years saturated with prayer, going here, going there, going. Do we think we can cut it with little prayer or no prayer at all? Are we serious? Are we willing to wrestle with something in prayer? It's one of the keys to us, one of the keys to you, to me, when it comes to winning whatever battle we may have. You read about a fellow Christian over in the book of Colossians, chapter 4 and verse 12, Epaphras or Epaphras. He was always wrestling in prayer on your behalf, on behalf of the Colossians. We need to imitate that guy. We need to imitate that fellow, all right? That fellow servant and his prayer life. Yeah, you want to overcome temptation. When you face that temptation, you need to saturate your life with prayer, just like Christ. The other thing, the other application point I want to make here, has to do with the overwhelming transformation that prayer brings. There is a change effected by the earnest and eager prayers of Jesus. We saw that in Matthew. I think we see it here as well when he rises from prayer and goes to his disciples in Luke. The sorrow is gone. The distress seems to have melted away. He's like, get up, let's go, let's roll. He looks different. And he acts different. He's ready to do the will of God. And he's eager to do it. Let's go. Get up. I'm ready. The Father's will became his will in prayer. In prayer, the Father's will becomes our will. We adopt it. We assume it for ourselves. There's something about being with God that changes us. There's something about being in constant conversation with him. We're different. We think different. We act different. It enables us to accept the no answers, even when maybe we don't understand why. So it's critical that we cultivate and we develop a prayer life like Jesus's. Will it be exactly like, no, because he's Jesus. But he presents the model, the example, and he says, come walk with me. Come walk with me as you live life with God, as you converse with the Father, just like I, come walk with me. And so it's critical that we cultivate this, or else we will give in to temptation and or we'll pursue our own will and not God's will. We seek to transform our prayer life so that God can transform us. That's why we would even look at the prayer life of Jesus. Jesus rises from prayer transformed, but he rises from prayer to find that his disciples have neglected theirs, their prayers. It reminds me of a parable that Jesus told over in Luke 18 about praying always and not losing heart. He told them a parable to the effect that they ought always to pray and not lose heart. He said, in a certain city there was a judge who neither feared God nor respected man. And there was a widow in that city who kept coming to him and saying, give me justice against my adversary. For a while he refused, but afterward he said to himself, though I neither fear God nor respect man, yet because this widow keeps bothering me, I will give her justice so that she will not beat me down by her continual coming. And the Lord said, hear what the unrighteous judge says. And will not God give justice to his elect who cry to him day and night? Will he delay long over them? I tell you, he will give justice to them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth? That's the point. The end of the parable there. When the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on earth? When Jesus returned from his time in prayer, what did he find? And now here's the question for us. As we contemplate this, when Jesus comes back the final time, what will he find? Will he find transformed people of prayer, people who readily and eagerly seek to do the will of the Father? Because again, that's what prayer does. It enables us to line up our will with God's will. Will he find us faithful, prayerfully pursuing the will of God? Sponsor this half hour, Merced Church of Christ, located at 2050 Yosemite Parkway. Merced Church of Christ is composed of people devoted to the Word of God, people devoted to the worship of God, and people devoted to the work of God. Our mission is to seek out and find willing people to be obedient to Christ and to live according to his will. Merced Church of Christ meets every Lord's Day, that Sunday, for Bible study at 9:30 a.m., morning worship at 10:30 a.m., and evening worship at 6 p.m. We also meet for midweek Bible study every Wednesday at 7 p.m. We wish you'd stop by and visit us sometime. Merced Church of Christ is served by her preaching minister, yours truly. Go online and visit mercedchurchofchrist.org. Merced Church of Christ, making and maturing disciples. Today in church history, I should say on or around this day, in church history, William Law is suspended from his pulpit for nonconformist views. Now, he'll go on to become famed as an author because of his work, A Serious Call to a Devout and Holy Life. That's a classic, by the way. You can find the PDF online. You can download it. It's worth it. But his book, Power of the Spirit, that will be more evangelical. But connected to what we're talking about as far as prayer is concerned, chapter 14 of A Serious Call to a Devout and Holy Life is concerning that part of devotion which relates to times and hours of prayer, of daily eager prayer in the morning, how we are to improve our forms of prayer, and how to increase the spirit of devotion. So we're just talking about prayer. I commend that chapter to you. Look it up. You can find it via the World Wide Web. But here's one quote from A Serious Call to a Devout and Holy Life I'll share with you. Grant that I may worship and pray unto thee with as much reverence and godly fear as if I saw the heavens open and all the angels that stand around thy throne. Amen. So that's William Law, A Serious Call to a Devout and Holy Life. But it was on this day 302 years ago that he was suspended from his pulpit for nonconformist views.
And now it's time for the question of the day.
This is the question of the day on Life from the Pulpit.
Why does God hear our prayers? Why does God hear our prayers? You know, that's a good question. Here you have the cosmic sovereign ruler of the universe, and he's interested in what we have to say to him. Why does he listen? Why would the sovereign God listen? Is it because of who I am? Is it because of what I've done? Is it because of what I will do? The answer to all those questions is no, it's not because of who I am. According to the Bible, we're all weak, ungodly sinners who were enemies of God at one time. Is it because of what I've done? Well, no, because there's nothing you can do to deserve your Father's ear. Nor is it because of what you will do. Listen, it is not because of who you are or what you do that God loves you or that would cause him to incline his ear to you. I'm persuaded that the primary reason that a sovereign God would choose to listen to us in prayer is because he chooses to. It's because he decides to. It's because of his good pleasure that he inclines his ear to his children, to his people. Again, he is not obliged to hear anything we blabber at him. You understand? We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Every one of us has turned to his own way. So it can't be because of who we are or because of what we've done. It must be because of who he is as a sovereign God. And he chooses in his sovereignty. He decides that he will listen to us. And he desires to. It's his good pleasure to hear what his children, what his people are requesting of him, and what they are saying to him. There's nothing you can say that would cause him to incline his ear. No, he inclines his ear because he decides to hear what you are saying to him. That's, I'm persuaded, why a sovereign God would choose to hear us. It's because of his good pleasure. I mean, it was, after all, according to his good pleasure that he would redeem us and save us and adopt us. That's over in Ephesians chapter 1. It was according to his good pleasure, according to the purpose of his will, that he would lavish on us wisdom and insight, riches of his grace, all these things. And so when it comes to prayer, why would he hear? Well, for the same reason. It's his good pleasure. He desires to hear us. And that's good news, because if it's dependent upon you or me or my track record or whatever, we're not making it, all right? I'm out of time. Feel free to leave a comment on the website. We'd like to hear what you have to say. Search Facebook, Life from the Pulpit. Like the Facebook page. You'll get all the updates when I go live with a podcast, update the blog, or post a new video on YouTube. Speaking of YouTube, search YouTube, Life from the Pulpit, and you'll see all the Question of the Day segments there when you subscribe. Follow me on Twitter, @InPulpit, at the letter N as in Nick, Pulpit, P-U-L-P-I-T. Be sure and stop by the Life from the Pulpit blog, L-I-F-E from the pulpit.wordpress.com. All of my commentary there on Luke, James, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, John, Philippians, now Ephesians, all there, all available, all free, for you to use and peruse in your everyday Bible study. Now on iTunes, search the iTunes store, download all the episodes to your particular iDevice. You'll never be more than a click away from an episode of the podcast. Check out Merced Church of Christ website, mercedchurchofchrist.org, mercedchurchofchrist.org. Plenty of sermon audio there as well to help you in your daily walk with the Lord. And as always, brethren, grace be with you all. Thanks for listening.